This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. This weekend, four immigrants from Danbury, Connecticut will be honored by nonprofit The American Dream, the New American Dream Foundation, that is. Coming up, Vice President Emanuela Palmeres will join us to talk about why the nonprofit has worked to highlight the contributions of local immigrants each year. Is the American Dream a myth? Depends on who you ask. But one thing most of us can agree on, we all want to live a life where we're comfortable and healthy, where we can provide for our family, and if we have kids, ensure they can, when they become adults too, that they have a good life. But economists say it all depends on where you live, for one thing. Other factors that shouldn't be surprising include where you go to school, your childhood environment, and whether you've been able to earn a college degree. Now, do you believe in the American dream? Are you in a better place than your parents were at your age? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. In a few minutes, we'll hear from an economist and a sociologist about the factors that encourage upward mobility. But first, a recent Pew study finds Generation X, the people born after the mid-1960s and up to the mid-80s. This group is the only generation of households to recover what they lost during the Great Recession. For more, joining us by phone is Richard Fry, senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. Richard, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
I understand it was the Gen Xers who bore the brunt of the Great Recession in the beginning. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. The Gen Xers, those born under Pew definitions between 1965 and 1980, back sort of during the days of the housing peak, 2004 to 2007, they were sort of in their sort of middle years, and as they were building their wealth, they were acquiring houses, so they were buying houses at pretty high prices before the housing crash. They took a lot of debt on to do it. For many American households, a lot of their wealth is in their house, and so Generation X, given their recent entry into the housing market, they were the ones that suffered the greatest declines in home equity, some of them being foreclosed on, and percentage-wise, they took, for the typical median wealth level, they took the largest decline, again, largely because they were overly heavily involved in the housing market.
And especially if they bought homes closer to when that bubble burst, a lot of money put into a home when you buy, but not a lot of time to build up that equity, as you mentioned.
Yes, yeah. They were, again, highly leveraged. They had a lot of debt relative to the value of their homes. And leverage works really good when home prices are rising. But at least nationally, in many housing markets, home prices fell. And so for some of them, their stakes got wiped out. Some of them were underwater. Some of them were foreclosed on. And so, yeah, in terms of wealth, it was particularly Generation X households that were hit hard by the downturn.
Now, how did that compare to, say, the baby boomer generation or even the millennials?
Okay, so again, sticking with wealth, to put some numbers on it in terms of the hit they took, these are Federal Reserve data from 2007 to 2010. The typical wealth level, again, the median for Gen Xers, they fell about 38%. But for the boomers, their sort of typical wealth level fell about 26%. Now, for the millennials, you got to remember the oldest millennial today is 37 years old. So back, if we go all the way back to 2007, the millennials were very young, okay? And so I don't want to say that they weren't hit by the Great Recession. They were in terms of the labor market, in terms of finding work and in terms of the jobs they could get. But they were very young. All young adult households, they have very little wealth. They had very little wealth back then, and so they didn't have much to lose. They were just starting to build their nest eggs. And so when you actually look at the Federal Reserve figures, again, this isn't really – the wealth levels were so low that actually they didn't – so measurement-wise, they didn't lose anything. But again, it's because they had very small nest eggs to begin with. So in terms of wealth, they weren't affected much.
There's also the silent generation. Describe who they are and how they were hit by the recession.
Okay, so the silent generation, this is, again, a common label for the generation before the boomers. They were born from 1928 to 1945. So get my age right. Back in 2007, sort of this, they would have been, say, ages 62 to 79. So they were sort of already entering into sort of the retirement period. Many of them were retired. And for example, their wealth levels back in 2007, according to the Fed data, their typical household wealth was about $268,000. By 2010, it was about $231,000. So they took about a 14% drop in their wealth levels. So they were hit, but not as hard as younger generations. And again, it's because they had more of their assets away from housing. They were more into financial assets, less into housing. And so, again, typically the Fed data sort of show is that households that had most of their wealth in housing took the biggest hit. For example, households out west also took a bigger hit because they had more of their wealth in housing.
I'm talking with Richard Fry, senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. Now, Richard, you did an analysis of, again, Generation X and where they stand today, and they've recovered pretty well. Why is that?
Well, I want to be careful. They have recovered. They've gotten back their wealth levels, according to the Fed data in 2016, the latest data available. Their wealth levels are back above where they were in 2007. And that's not true for the boomers and the silent generation. Several things have occurred that have basically, with rising asset prices, both home prices in many housing markets have recovered to where they were back in 2004, 2005. That, again, that varies from housing market to housing market. As far as the stock market, that's now sort of at record highs, and that's recovered. But the key thing, I think, for Generation X is keep in mind, they were young. They're still young. The oldest Gen Xer is still only 53 years of age. And so there's retirement really is not an issue for them. And they've gotten older and they're starting to hit their peak earning years. And so that with higher earnings, higher income, that allows you to save more. And so what we see, both in terms of their housing wealth, their home equity is back above where it once was, but also their financial assets are also back above where they were. So part of it is just sort of where they are in the life cycle is that they're still approaching their peak earnings years, whereas the boomers and the silents, they're getting older. Some of their earnings and their earners in the household are starting to leave the labor market as well. Since they're older, they're starting to draw down their wealth, use their nest eggs. And so boomers and silents have not backed to where they were in 2007. Gen X is. Now, there's one qualifier, though. Okay. So the oldest Gen Xer is now 53 years of age. Well, what's their typical wealth level? Their typical total wealth level is about $84,000. So they've recovered, but one can still ask, are they where they need to be as they start to approach their retirement years? And again, that's a difficult question to ask, but I think some people would say, given the fact that they don't even have six digits, you know, even $100,000 sort of squirreled away, that they are probably not well prepared for what's coming for them. But I won't get into sort of whether they're ill prepared or not. But they only have about their typical wealth level is about $84,000 according to the Fed figures.
Now you mentioned nest eggs, and when we talk about the baby boomers and older Americans, they did see a hit to their retirement. Some of them even had to put off retirement because of the Great Recession. And you, as you mentioned, they have yet to recover what they lost.
That's correct. And I think, you know, again, for the boomers now, as of 2016, their typical wealth level, again, a lot of it is in their homes. It's not in sort of liquid financial assets, but it's about $184,000, according to the Fed figures. Again, there are concerns as to sort of particularly for the boomers about, you know, sort of whether they're prepared. And remember, they're getting older now, where the oldest boomer is now 72 years of age. And so many of them are beyond their peak earnings years. Some of them are wanting to leave the labor market, and clearly there are concerns about sort of how well the boomers are going to be prepared for their retirement years.
Richard Fry, again, is senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. We're going to tweet out a link to Pew's analysis of Generation X. You can find us at Where We Live. Richard, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking about whether the idea of the American dream is really attainable, especially given the growing wealth and income inequality gap in the U.S. Now, how stable do you see your future or your children's future? We want to hear from you. Join our conversation, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. To talk more about this, joining us now from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. is John Lettieri. He's co-founder and president of the Economic Innovation Group. John, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
Also with us from on the phone is Michael Hout, professor of sociology at New York University. Michael, welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning, Lucy. Thanks for having me on.
So I started the show talking about the so-called American dream. I wanted to ask both of you how this idea is defined today. I'll start with you, John. What is the American dream today?
Well, I think the American dream is what it has always been, which is the idea that if you work hard and if you play by the rules, that you have a great shot of rising beyond your starting point in life in this country, that this is a land of opportunity. And that's certainly true for millions of Americans, but I think we know better today than we ever have that your zip code has a lot to say about your access to the American dream. And that's something that's become more challenging in the wake of the Great Recession and the uneven recovery. As we know more about the impact that place has on people's lives, we can see the fault lines in terms of people's access nationwide to economic prosperity and opportunity. And we see some factors that frankly seem arbitrary that challenge our notion of this being broadly a land of opportunity for everybody.
When you say the factors that are arbitrary, tell us more about that.
Well, it's the lottery of birth. You don't choose your zip code of birth, and you don't choose, for the most part, where you grow up. And yet we know that those are factors that play an overwhelmingly important role in all kinds of different life outcomes, from your health to your success in marriage to your lifetime earnings. And those are not factors that have much to do with your zip code doesn't have much to do with the level of effort you put in or your intelligence or other things that seem innate. And so that proposition of is this a fair proposition for Americans who happen to be born or raised in areas that are downwardly mobile or suppress people's upward mobility? That's something that I think challenges our notion, in particular in the policymaking arena, of how we should expand access to opportunity and how much we should try to bring opportunity to people rather than just expecting people to make it on their own.
Michael, you're a sociologist at NYU. When you think about the American dream and how it's viewed today, do you want to respond to what John has talked about in terms of how it can be unattainable, depending on where you were born and where you live?
Well, my focus actually is on what your parents do for a living, and I've been looking at occupational mobility over the last 22 years with some new data from the General Social Survey, new data about the past, and find that actually things are worse off than we thought they were, and yet at the same time unchanged over the whole 22-year period. So there's a bit of a paradox there, if I might unpack it just a little bit.
Sure.
The idea is that as important as zip code is, the occupation of your parents weighs heavily into that, and their fortunes are no doubt affected by that zip code that John was talking about.
We started the show talking a little bit about the recovery of one demographic, and that's Generation X since the start of the Great Recession. But when we look at economic mobility, is that something we need to look further back than 2007 to talk about where we are today, John?
Yeah, if you look at trends in economic mobility, there's a mixed story here. On some measures, economic mobility has declined because standards of living have increased so much since the beginning of the 20th century. So it's harder to set the same pace, to keep the same pace of growth over a long period of time and say we're going to continue to have the same type of mobility over a substantially risen standard of living. But in relative terms, people also look at versus your peers, how likely are you to rise, not just versus your parents. And so it's a mixed bag across as far as we have data that goes back. What's changed, I think, pretty dramatically is this question of place and how the country's economy, which we often talk about as a monolithic thing, really does divide along geographic fault lines that have a tremendous impact on the way people experience the economy and their view of the national economy, because they're looking out their window, not looking at national data sets. And that's something where we have a really troubling picture in the more recent frame of a recession and a recovery that have left a much wider gap between prosperous places and distressed places than what we saw entering the recession. So we have a real challenge here of diverging trajectories. It's not just that distressed areas are failing to keep pace. It's that in many cases, and this means for tens of millions of Americans, their communities are actually still in recession for all intents and purposes. They're still losing jobs. They're still losing businesses. And so it's not just growing at different rates. It's you have a backward momentum for tens of thousands of communities around the country. And that just stands in stark contrast to our understanding of today's economy being a booming one. And it is at the national level. But I think our work has tried to underscore we have to get beneath the national headlines, beneath those national statistics, to understand how people are actually experiencing the economy in their own backyard.
This is Where We Live. Today, we're talking about the so-called American dream. My guest today, John Lettieri, co-founder and president of the Economic Innovation Group, and Michael Hout, professor of sociology at New York University. You can join us, too, 860-275-7266. Colleen is calling from Farmington. Colleen, go ahead.
Hi. So I, just to give you some background, I am considered a millennial. I graduated from college back in 2011. And since I've graduated, I have had part-time and full-time positions in the nonprofit sector. And what I'm finding is that, as from my personal experience, I'm not sure whether I'm going to be able to move forward and have the so-called American dream. I'm finding in my job search right now, I was laid off back in November. I had a job that didn't really fit for about a month, and now I'm back where I started. I'm finding that not only is the bachelor's considered the new high school diploma, because you can't get anywhere without having a bachelor's. And in terms of different career paths, my degree is in communications. So even though I have a wide range of opportunities, it's exceedingly hard when you're up against hundreds of applicants who may have had a degree in a specific field, like marketing or business. Something that is more concrete, and you can do a specific thing.
Now, Colleen, one of our guests, Michael Hout, he's going to be talking more about his study and how the occupation of parents can play into the success of children as they grow. Is that something that you think impacted you at all, or is it just a wrong time in terms of graduating and trying to find a job with where the economy was at that point?
I think it's more of when I graduated and trying to find a job. My parents, they have their own business. They've been very successful. And on my end, I'm still struggling because of the major that I chose. And the economy in Connecticut is not as good as it is projected to be. We may have a 4% unemployment rate, but that doesn't factor in the people that have stopped looking for work because their unemployment benefits have been exhausted.
Well, thank you, Colleen, for calling in. I wanted to have our guests respond. First, I'll go to Michael. We were hearing a little bit about why Colleen feels like her financial future is not secure. Did you want to respond to what she shared with us?
Well, two things. First of all, I think that I hear what she's saying about the need for a college degree. It's extremely important, and indeed that's the main mechanism by which parents influence their children's subsequent success or lack thereof. Is the some parents are in a position to finance their kids' college educations, and others are not. And even those, that's a huge factor. It was also interesting to hear her say that, you know, the Connecticut job market isn't as strong as she'd like, and I'm eager to hear what John has to say about it, because I love his map, because it mm-hmm. goes beyond the usual, you know, the coasts are strong and the middle is struggling typology that we use. There are actually substantial zones of opportunity spread throughout the country. There are parts near the coast that are struggling, and parts well inland, where there are substantial opportunities for young people, and so I urge everybody to go click on follow the link on your website to his map. It's just, I could spend all day looking at this, but I have other stuff to do.
I usually have to pay for that kind of marketing, so thank you.
Well, John Lettieri, we got to go to break soon, but tell us a little bit about respond to what Colleen had shared with us, and the idea of depending on place where Americans see success.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, because we live in a time right now where so much of what you hear from the private sector is we cannot find enough workers. There just aren't enough workers to fill the jobs we have open. And yet you still do find people like Colleen who feel like they're a mismatch in the labor market. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, whether you're willing to leave where you are to find a better labor market. Connecticut has a relatively strong baseline, so it's not a distressed area as a state. But it also hasn't seen very dynamic growth since the end of the recession. So it's a little bit more of a treading water economy, which for people who are on the outside looking in can be very frustrating. And that's one of the challenges we see post-Great Recession, is just overall a much less dynamic economy. And I'd love to unpack that more maybe after the break. But one of the features of that is much less geographic mobility, mm-hmm. Which means even when people are faced with relatively poor local economy, they aren't responding the way the Americans typically responded in previous generations, where they picked up and moved. We move at roughly half the rate that we did just in the 1990s. And so that's a pretty big turnaround, and one that really emphasizes, if people are more stuck in place than in previous generations, we really have to understand the impact of place more than we once did.
And we are going to talk more about that coming up here on Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. John Lettieri joining us from NPR in Washington, D.C. He's co-founder and president of the Economic Innovation Group. And Michael Haupt, professor of sociology at New York University. And we want to hear from you, too. Do you still believe in the so-called American dream? You can join us, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're focusing in on the idea of the American dream. Americans are taught that if you work hard, you can move ahead in life and often be in a better financial boat than your parents were. But is that still true? We want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. My guests today are John Lettieri, co-founder and president of the Economic Innovation Group, and Michael Haupt, professor of sociology at New York University. John, before the break, we were talking more about this map that your organization has come up with in terms of looking at economic mobility. So tell us more about the factors that distinguish a town or city that's more economically mobile versus one that's not.
Sure. Well, the map that we've created is an index to look at community economic well-being. So not just the poverty rate and not just individual income, but a wider array of factors: education attainment, housing vacancy, change in jobs and businesses, et cetera, to try to get a broader proxy for what is the overall economic environment of a given place. And we map every zip code in the country with over 500 people. We use that data to sort zip codes against that index into tiers of prosperity. And why do we do that? Again, it's to get back to that question of we need to stop thinking of the U.S. economy or any economy as monolithic, and understand when you're talking about job or business growth, when you're talking about income improvement, you have to ask about the distribution of those gains. Where are they going? And so one of the striking things that we've found over the course of the recovery is that, again, while at the national level, a lot of these stats look good, mm-hmm. the distribution has been extremely concentrated in prosperous and comfortable areas. So if you look by place, prosperous places are generating by far the most jobs and businesses on net during the course of the recovery. In fact, along many measures, they've generated more than the rest of the country combined. So that top 20% of places reaping the overwhelming benefits of the great the recovery from the Great Recession. And so that has a huge impact, again, on how people can access economic opportunity. And if you're in a place that's on the outside looking in, for example, the bottom 20%, where 50 million Americans live, their losses in jobs and businesses has not stopped. So their recession, you're talking about a lost decade for those Americans. And that's a truly profound thing, because typically when you have a booming economy, go back to the 1990s, for example, if you closed your eyes in the 1990s and put your finger on the map, you were better than even odds at landing on a place that had as strong of a growth rate in jobs and businesses as the national economy as a whole. So most places reflected the national picture, and that's shrunk down to just a quarter today. So as an economy, we're much more reliant on a narrow base of people and places to carry those national growth rates. And so when I think a lot of Americans hear about a booming economy and a robust labor market, they find it hard to square with what they're seeing in their own local economies, and that has a big impact on mobility. And it actually, our findings run counter to some of the traditional thinking about winning places and losing places today. For example, our research, when we crosswalked it with an economist named Raj Chetty, who's done fantastic work looking at economic mobility, we found that the most powerful engines of upward mobility in this country were rural, prosperous places in the Great Plains and Upper Midwest. And I think a lot of Americans don't typically think of rural America as particularly dynamic or upwardly mobile, but there are still places in this country where that's the best possible place to be. And this gets to the point that being poor in one area means something very different than being poor in another area. And it gets back to what we talked about earlier, that that's quite arbitrary, your zip code really does have this massive impact, even if your starting point in individual terms is the same as it would be somewhere else. So those broader conditions matter. I think this research we're talking about now about what your parents do, your occupation, it shows that there's environmental factors that play a huge role. So understanding that, we should use public policy to really strengthen social capital and to incentivize the right type of healthy behavior and risk-taking that leads to more opportunity for everybody.
You mentioned the term social capital, so let's talk more about that because you also mentioned economist Raj Chetty's research, this idea that there are places in our country, and he uses the example of Salt Lake City, where there is a lot of social capital, where people who are needing help can find it, and that's how you see upward mobility happening?
Yeah, that's one key. Salt Lake City and Utah in general, you know, it seems to be one of the national leaders in the arena of social capital, which it's actually interesting now that that has become a point of focus for researchers. You're actually seeing this interesting project on Capitol Hill at the Joint Economic Committee, a social capital project to try to map and define social capital, quantify that around the country, and understand what are places that are doing well on that measure and what are places that are struggling. But the impact is profound, and it gets to this issue of it's not just about the individual or even about the individual's family. It's about the surrounding circumstances. You're much better off if you're poor and you live in a non-segregated, highly integrated, diverse area where there's a lot of two-parent households, for example, even if you yourself don't live in a two-parent household. So these are issues that we know matter, but what to do about them and how to factor that into policymaking and other decision-making is quite challenging.
You can join our conversation on Where We Live, 860-275-7266. Sarah's calling from Southeast Connecticut. Sarah, go ahead.
Hi. I just want to make a comment or two. I'm actually from I was born in 1950. And I did move around the country to find a job that was enjoyable for me and fit in with my plan. I did not find it easy at any level because of the specification of a job. I did things that people didn't do. And then now you have to get a certification for it. So I ended up without job opportunities, although I re-educated myself as best I could. So your description doesn't quite fit with my experience. I was a nurse, by the way, master's level nurse. And I found that it was extremely difficult to get ahead in any region. I worked in Kansas, I worked in Sacramento, I worked in Connecticut, I worked in Massachusetts, and I worked in New Hampshire. I do fit the picture of more mobility, mm-hmm. but the economic situation in a particular state, given your particular professional career, is going to be an issue no matter what state you're in.
Well, thank you, Sarah, for your call. John, did you want to respond?
No, except just to say that I think it's certainly true that there's a difference between an individual's experience or the impact in an individual's life, something that may be totally rational at an individual level. If you multiply that on a national scale, may have negative effects, and vice versa. There could be things that are positive at a national scale that present challenges for the individual. So I certainly hear where she's coming from.
I wanted to bring Michael Haupt back into the conversation, professor of sociology at New York University. I was curious about the role of higher education when we think about mitigating disparities in economic mobility. What have you found in your research, Michael, about how earning that college degree, how that can help some people, but not all people, because we hear so often about the level of debt that people hold because they've gone on to higher education?
Well, the first thing I want to say about it is that there are few investments you can make in yourself or in your children that pay off better than a college education. But on the other hand, the landscape is treacherous. The public higher education generally, students who avail themselves of public education leave with less debt than those who go to not-for-profit private universities, and the people who have the highest debt are those who go to the for-profits. Now, sometimes that works out because they arrange job interviews for you and so on. But for the most part, the really high debt that we see these days is from the highly unregulated for-profit region that sector of higher education that for a while the Obama administration was regulating, but the current administration has substantially rolled back those regulations. Student, beware. You, before taking out that loan, be very careful about the terms of it. I also want to point out that there's an important way in which higher education cancels the effect of parents, in the sense that if you beat the odds as a person who grew up in a lower class or even a working class background and get that college education, your parents' occupation is no longer a drag on your future. It's among those who don't have credentials that the long hand of parents' opportunities continues to influence their careers.
We heard John Lettieri mentioning a lot of the data that's out there and why this should be used to drive public policy. Let's talk about that, of how policy can change. Again, John Lettieri from the Economic Innovation Group. Some ideas of policies that could help people become more mobile. You mentioned people aren't moving as often as they used to, maybe because they do feel stuck. At the same time, we have listeners who would say there are investments to help people with affordable housing or to get, a leg up. How much more can government invest to help these individuals? And maybe is the investment going in the wrong direction?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is one of those things we have to say at the outset. There's no single cause and no single cure for these broader challenges. But even before we think about what type of public sector investments, and there certainly are some in the education and workforce space that make a lot of sense, before we get to that point, you want to also ask, what have we allowed to creep in that we should stop doing or stop allowing? there are a couple of things that have changed pretty dramatically in the last few decades that disproportionately harm lower-income and middle-income Americans and disproportionately advantage concentrated power and interest in the private sector. And so what am I talking about here? Occupational licensing being one, where we've seen a multifold increase in the number of professions nationwide that require a license to do work. And it's this terrible patchwork from one state to another. In most cases, the license doesn't transfer. So if you move to another state, you have to go through the whole process again. Every bit of research we have says it doesn't actually protect consumers or bring any kind of consumer benefit or safety. It has deep negative ramifications for people's economic and geographic mobility and costs more to consumers. So it's kind of poisonous across the board. One thing it does very well, though, is protect incumbents from competition. And that's really in many ways what it's designed to do, is to create protected industries where the current occupants get to decide who competes with them and who doesn't. And that idea of competition and allowing marketplaces to work as they're intended is really important, because we have to start with a level playing field. You can't expect people to have to take care of themselves and work hard and play by the rules and then pull out the planks of economic stability and opportunity from underneath them. And you see this in the no poach arena, where major fast food franchises are some of the worst offenders. They have collusionary behavior among employers that say, we won't hire your exiting staffer if you don't hire ours. And so for this, again, disproportionately affects low income workers who are just trying to get their first foot on the ladder of opportunity. That keeps them from being able to bid up their wages. Same thing with non-competes, which also have a very harmful effect on entrepreneurship. So the more that we concentrate power in a few hands, and the more that we stifle healthy competition in a healthy marketplace, folks that are college educated, have an advanced degree, who live in dynamic areas, they're going to be fine. But it's low and middle income workers and their kids that are going to be harmed by this. And then we have to pay more on the back end to try to compensate for the negative symptoms of that. So I think a lot of what we should be focused on in the policy arena is what to stop doing. And so much of it is about injecting healthy competition and transparent marketplaces, rather than allowing for essentially the game to be rigged. And this is where I thought in the 2016 election, we started to hear a lot about this rigging of the system. And while I would personally take issue with some of the solutions that were put forward as to what to do about it, I think the premise is right, that for many Americans, that idea that the economy is a bit rigged against you, especially if you don't have a college or advanced degree, rings true, because that's their experience in these areas that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm.
Earlier, you'd mentioned about the importance of where people live. Another place that gets criticism in terms of assistance is many Americans need housing assistance, but to be able to pay your rent and to stay in the same low-income neighborhood without the opportunity to move to a mixed-income neighborhood, that lessens your chances of being able to pull yourself up and have a better job and a stronger income to support your family.
Well, that's one of the most egregious examples of how places that are prosperous have used zoning and land use regulation to create gated communities, essentially, where it's very hard for low and middle income people to move in. It's very hard in many cases for low and middle income people to stay because of restrictive zoning and the inability, the unwillingness to build enough housing to meet a diverse array of needs. And we see this so clearly in our research, that many of the most prosperous and equal places are prosperous and equal. The equal part is because they've done a good job at creating an enclave and making sure that lower middle income people can't come in. We've got to do better on that. And that's really a local issue. It's there's only so many levers the federal government can pull. Everything I mentioned, by the way, is primarily a state and local policy issue. And if we really wanted to expand opportunity, we would take those issues seriously. And I think, frankly, a little sunlight does wonders here. In the no-poach arena, once an economist named Alan Krueger did some research on this and shined a spotlight on the collusionary behavior, McDonald's and many other major franchises said, we're going to stop doing it. In fact, they claimed to not even know they were doing it at the corporate leadership level. So it didn't take a piece of legislation. It took some research and some publicity to show just how egregious and in how many ways we actually silently harm the prospects and the stability of people who don't have a lot of economic power in our communities.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank John Lettieri again, co-founder and president of the Economic Innovation Group, joining us today from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. John, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Also, Michael Hout, professor of sociology at New York University. Again, Michael, we're going to tweet out a link to your research. Michael, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Lucy. Goodbye.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, the idea of the American dream is something many in immigrant communities believe in strongly. We're going to find out more about a community in the western side of the state that is looking to highlight the contributions of their immigrant residents. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up tomorrow, Hartford has a new top cop. Joining us tomorrow in studio and on Facebook Live is Hartford's Police Chief David Rosato. And you can join us, too. That's coming up tomorrow on Where We Live. Now, opportunity has led millions of Americans to move to the U.S., but as we discussed earlier, achieving the so-called American dream depends on a lot of factors, not just on the idea of working hard. Still, our nation's success is due in part to the contributions of immigrants. A nonprofit in Danbury, Connecticut, has worked to highlight the lives of local immigrants in an annual awards ceremony. For more, joining us now is Emanuela Palmeres, Vice President of the New American Dream Foundation. Emanuela, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Lucy.
We don't have a lot of time, but tell us a little bit about your family roots, because you moved here with your family from Brazil as a child.
I did. We came chasing my parents' American dream, in a way. And I believe that's why it's one of this country's greatest export. I think the concept of the American dream really starts at the hearts of all the people that have come before us chasing something mystical about this country. So I don't think it's as concrete as things that happened directly after the Great Depression, but it's really a concept that's always been here. And we came from Brazil with nothing when I was around 10 years old. I've been here for 25 years, and we came from depending on a lot of the services that offered in our community, from getting bread at the Salvation Army and sleeping on mattresses in our first apartment and not having beds, to now setting up a foundation to help other people define and achieve their American dream.
You're vice president of the New American Dream Foundation. Why the New American Dream versus the typical American dream?
It's this conversation that you're having today. That's why for us it's so interesting. We believe that the American dream, as people know it, is this idea that is tied down to an economic period, an economic growth, and access to physical material things, where we wanted to put the new in because we felt that immigrants kind of bring this fresh, new perspective to what is the American dream. When we talk about education, does it mean higher education, or does it mean just achieving, getting a certificate for a trade or learning a language? When we talk about, you know, feeling happy, does it include feeling healthy? Does it include just having access to feeling like you're a whole person? And the perspective of immigrants is what makes that new. And I think that's one of the greatest things that immigrants bring into you, literally their physical and their emotional baggage, is that, you know, ask a Brazilian about corruption comparison to the times we're living now. Ask a Venezuelan about the economy compared to the times that we're living now. So we always look at this country with a sprinkle of admiration, no matter how bad things are, because we know better. We know that things could always get worse.
So when we were talking about the American dream, and whether it's fading or if it was always a myth, to immigrants, the new American dream, it means something completely different, because they're more optimistic about the future and what they're able to bring and help support their family?
It's renewed with every person that comes in, because you're bringing your own definition of the American dream. And I think that for most immigrants in their immigration journey, in their status, the ultimate American dream is to become an American. And I think there's something very poetic and beautiful about that, that it's not attached to a house, it's not attached to a diploma, it's not attached to stats, it's attached just to be a part of this place. Could be the biggest dream of them all. And for us at our foundation, we just want to help guide people, define that dream, but also let them know along their way that we see them and that we value this new definition that they're bringing to the table.
When we look at immigration policy in this country and the rhetoric that's continued now through several different presidents, mm-hmm. When immigrants hear that rhetoric, is their optimism less full, so to speak?
No, because the risk was too great, right? So when you give up everything you have and you know to come to this country, it takes a lot more than sticks and stones to deter your passion and your goal. And most immigrants come with a very personal goal of achieving something for their own kind, their family, their children, either back home or with them. So it's what we're seeking, it's more important than what people think about us. And in that process, we teach the lessons of what's really important in life, which is really have a sense of community, be a part of something you love and fight for the people you love and work hard. And we think that's really the final recipe to achieve this thing that we call the American dream that every family gets to redefine. And we know for a fact in our foundation that we look at it, it's that some people are waiting for a 2050 census to feel this change. We are already living the redefinition of all these American values through the eyes of the immigrant community. And I think that overall, when all is said and done and the dust has settled, they will see that this is a new vibrant wave of Americans. They're just as passionate and patriotic as the one that came before them.
Mm. We did have a caller who called in earlier and said there are two American dreams, the new American dream and the American dream. He believes both are under attack. Do you agree?
I don't agree because I literally live and work with the immigrant community for 20 years. And like I said, it takes a lot more to deter us. Mm-hmm. I'm very fortunate. It took us 15 years to become American citizens. But when I did get to go back, the insight that I got, because I left when I was 10 years old, into my dad's village and the prospect of him never leaving that place, or actually the first plane that he ever got into was to come straight here. Mm-hmm. There's something that you can't even describe in words when you talk about the opportunity and the promise they're chasing of a land of just really stories of success. So I think it needs to be a lot bigger than that. And I think that what Americans can learn from the immigrant community is that you have been blessed. And at your worst, you're still the best. Mm.
I mentioned you're with the New American Dream Foundation, and for several years you've been honoring local immigrants. Tell us why, and who are you honoring this Saturday?
You know, my mother is the visionary behind this event. She's the president. That's why I'm the vice president. We still have a very, classic family dynamic from first immigrants coming in, so she's always the boss. And mom wanted to recognize other people who were in the same part of their journey that we were when we got here, but give them an extra push that she feel that she didn't have. Not only a keep going from the immigrant community, from the Native American-born community who was there, for them to understand that they may disagree in how people got here, but the one thing they have in common is a deep love and devotion for this country. So we honor people that have gotten here a couple of months ago or 3, 4, 6 generations ago with a Lifetime Achievement Award. And we connect those stories by just saying it may look different, but it's the same story. And people have coming here because there's something about this country that's special that enables them to achieve their full potential. And it's up to each one of us to define that and make that our goal.
We're going to have more information on our website, WMPR.org/where we live, about the people who will be honored this weekend, more about their biographies. But do you just want to quickly tell us the names of those up for awards?
Absolutely. One of our honorees is our Veteran of the Year. We always look for identifying our community, a member of our community who joined the military before becoming an American citizen, to show that's the ultimate sacrifice and the ultimate show of passion for our country. And that's Officer Hector Rodriguez, who also happens to be one of our Danbury police officers. And we also have our Students of the Year and our Person of the Year. A Lifetime Achievement Award winner is Mr. Hurdy, and his story is beautiful. He came to America chasing the love of his life after he met a redheaded American girl in a dance in Ireland. Mm-hmm.
And more on the people that are being honored on our website again. I want to thank Emmanuel Palmeres, Vice President of the New American Dream Foundation, also a great newspaper over on the western side of the state, Tribuna, which you and your mother are part of. So we thank you for coming in today to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today's show produced by Senior Producer Lydia Brown. Special thanks to Carmen Baskoff, Kion Wolf, and intern Philip Geolopsis. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.